Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As everyone knows, this is the last talk of this year's retreat, 2002, gone very fast. And even though it's the last talk of a retreat, that the meditation keeps on going on, you haven't got much choice about this. As I've been mentioning many times during the retreat period, in the talks and in interviews, that which we call the will, chetana, choice, the doer, that it doesn't belong to us, it's not a me, not a mine, not a self, and as such it is purely conditioned. Being conditioned, what I mean by that is that it's influenced by forces external to yourself, and those forces, from what you hear, from what you read, it's also external to the moment, it's influenced by your past, the karma from the past, as it were, which provides you inclinations, like forces which lead you in certain directions. And that will to investigate the Dhamma, to see the Dhamma, to realize the Dhamma, and to release the five khandhas from suffering, that's all part of this course, which, as it were, has to happen. When people hear deep teachings of the Buddha, then it leaves an imprint in the mind. And that imprint, like a seed, is only waiting for the time when it ripens. And it has to ripen at some time. And it's the seed of freedom, the seed of release. Everybody wishes to have release, wishes to have freedom. But again, during this retreat, you've heard me make a very big distinction between the two types of freedom in the world. The freedom of desires, which is the freedom to follow your desires, and the freedom from desires. And it's very good to understand the difference between those two freedoms and realize that which we call the freedom of desires, the freedom to pursue, you know, delightful sights, delightful sounds, delightful smells, delightful tastes, delightful bodily feelings. That pursuing delight, or the freedom to pursue delight, that you find never actually really gives you what it promises. It never gives you happiness. One thinks that if only one can have that ability to follow that such a freedom and have no obstacle in the way of one's search for happiness in that realm, if the obstacles were removed, then I will find, you know, my peace, my happiness. And that freedom of desires that you will know in the world will never actually reach perfection. It will never reach satisfaction. It just goes on and on and on. But you've also heard here that there's another type of freedom, the freedom from desires. That freedom from desires when there's no desires in the mind at all. There's nothing pushing you to go forward, to go backwards. There's no something pushing you to actually to go and get something more. It's the freedom from desires is known as contentment. Contentment is known as stillness. Stillness is known as peace. Peace is known as emptiness when everything is let go of. This is the nature of the mind. And here in this practice of the last 3 months, we've been following, encouraging, leaning towards the freedom from desires. And as you all know, the second noble truth, that's the freedom from craving. The freedom from that which gives rise to rebirth in the future. The freedom from that which gives rise to suffering. We're freeing ourselves from that by following the freedom from desires. The freedom from the cause of suffering. And that pursuit of such freedom, at least going in that direction for a short while, will every now and again give you the taste of freedom. That taste of freedom is not the taste of when you leave this monastery and you can go and do what you want. You can go and eat what you want, when you want, look at movies or whatever. That you realize that that's not freedom. Those of you who are leaving this monastery will be surprised that after one or two days of being able to do what you want, you won't find any freedom at all, and you look back upon the experience in a monastery as being times, surprisingly, when you've probably felt the most free of your life, with all these rules we have to keep, with all of the containment within the boundaries of the monastery, rarely going out, with all of the, you know, the core what, the monastery rules, and the eating rules, and the no talking rules, and all these other rules. You'll find actually, through experience, that this feels the greatest freedom, because it's getting closer to limiting desires, to limiting desires to almost nothing, to contentment. And that gives you the insights, gives you the understanding of what this path is all about, and why we run the monastery in this way, why the Buddha laid down the rules of Vinaya, and why we meditate in this way, and why we keep a comfortable lifestyle but not an indulgent lifestyle, because that, if you have too much asceticism, then that actually drives the desires to go even harder and more intense. Because you know what it's like if you really fast for too long, or if you're too tough upon yourself, that just makes the desires even stronger. And if you indulge too much, then that makes the desires even stronger. There's that middle way where the desires become the weakest, and that's where you can knock them over. And so that we're following that path of freedom from desires. And as we set up the monastery in this way, that obviously that the law of impermanence, of rise and fall change, means that sometimes during the last 3 months your desires are very strong, but there would have been some times when they were at their weakest. And the times when your desires were at their weakest were the times during this retreat you felt the most peace, the most contentment, the most freedom. Remember that. Why was that? And the reason why you felt the most freedom and contentment, because this is the real happiness, you know, when there's few desires. And that starts to incline you to the way of the Dhamma, the way of the practice. As you feel that that gives you the most happiness and peace in life, that's what you'll pursue sooner or later. And certainly that my own experience as a Buddhist, as a monk, it was always those peaceful, happy states of contentment, either in my meditation or in my general life, which led me to follow that happiness more and more, deeper and deeper, leading into monastic life, leading into deep meditation, leading, you know, to where I am now. This is what happens if you follow that path of contentment. And you find that with contentment you don't need so much. In fact, you need very little at all for contentment. And that reduces so many burdens from your life. You don't need other people to make you happy, and their all lust disappears there. What do you need other people for? Now, you don't even need health in the body to be happy. Now, you can become sick, and with that contentment of being sick, not wanting to be healthy, not wanting to have the pain disappear, but just fully content, not having any desire at all with the pain of the sickness, being with, and you find that there's freedom there. And it's an amazing experience to be free and feel that freedom. And feel you've got all the space in the world and everything is fine and there's nothing you want, even though you're in agony. And these are sort of amazing experiences which you may have touched yourself during the last 3 months. If you haven't touched them, you've gone close enough to understand what I mean. There have been times in your retreat period and when you felt that contentment and the wonderful happiness which surrounds that contentment. I remember one of the first experiences of that as a young man, a young schoolboy, just one afternoon finishing all my homework, and just having the afternoon off school. And there's nothing I wanted, nothing I needed to do. I remember that experience as an afternoon of utter contentment. Had no burdens at all. And that feeling of contentment was almost like an indicator, a pointer to something much deeper, which I was to pursue in monastic life. And so we follow those feelings of real happiness, of real peace, of real freedom, by following that path of no contentment, of freedom from desires. And I'm not telling you to do this. This is not, realizing this, those people who come to this monastery for the first time, those who have been here for a long time, know that there's no way that I will order anyone to do anything. And the reason why I don't order anyone to do things in this monastery or tell or guide like a dictator is that you don't need to do that. The way of practice is a way of following those inclinations, and they will happen automatically whether you like it or not. There's one of the powerful suttas in the Sanyutta Nikaya is the sutta which I think Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi was the first one to coin the term transcendental dependent origination. So no, actually not, that was not the one I was really had in mind, so I'll put that one aside. There's another sutta which I forget actually what it's called, but it says something like that for when a person has faith in the Buddha, faith in the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, I think it's when a person develops sila, develops virtue. And anyone who develops virtue, they don't need to think or make a determination that may I develop this pramudya, this what you might call it, just this delight, this happiness, this level of happiness, pramudya. You don't need to make a resolution that may pramudya sort of rise in me, because it's a natural course. It's like the Dhamma in the sense of a natural law, that anyone who develops and practices, cultivates virtue, will actually experience that happiness. And you've all been living very virtuous lives over the last 3 months. It hasn't been perfect, but you don't expect that to be perfect, but it's happy enough to give you a lot of happiness. A lot of the joy of monastic life is just living with virtuous people and living a virtuous lifestyle. That by itself is delightful, and it gives you that sort of pramudya, that rejoicing, just in the lifestyle. You don't need to actually to say, I'm going to practice and train to have that rejoicing. That happens naturally, in the same way that a person who practices such pramudya, they don't need to sort of decide they're going to go into the next step of piti. So that it happens that you get that joy which comes up, that inspired joy. The whole purpose of this particular sutta is where it says you don't need even to think and to make a resolution you do these things. It happens naturally, a natural course. Pramudya, many of you know that sequence, the next from pramudya to piti, from piti to pasadi, the tranquility of the body and the mind. Many of you have experienced the tranquility of the body and the mind. And you can recognize the tranquility of the body is when you can sit here and you don't need to move. I'm saying you don't need to move, you don't keep yourself still, just the body doesn't want to move. It's tranquilized, it's content, it's calmed down. And it's a very rare thing to see people so still. And if you go out into the world and watch people, they can't sit still on a chair for very long, they can't stand still. They're always on the move. No wonder their body gets tired, because it's driven backwards and forwards so much. If you want to rest, then you've got to be still. Even in bed, people aren't very still. They're always tossing and turning. But the pasadi of the body, the calm of the body, comes from piti and from joy. When you've got delight, joy, you don't want to move, because it's a degree of contentment. Contentment leads to stillness. And I'm sure that many of you in the meditation have enjoyed the stillness of the body, where you can sit there, and you're pretty peaceful, you can sit there for many hours sometimes. That's a sign of kaya pasadi, to be able to sit for long periods of time, because the body doesn't need to move. It's delightful when that happens. And of course, from that kaya pasadi, you don't need to make a resolution, I get citta pasadi, the tranquility of the mind. That comes, when there's no problems with the body, then the mind has got less problems to work with, less problems to bother about. It's just a natural cause and effect sequence that the mind becomes tranquil. This is why that when you sit in meditation, if you can't sit for long periods of time, and the body gets very, very still, even disappearing from your consciousness, so you're not perceiving the body, then the mind gets to a level of tranquility. That's great. And of course it's very enjoyable as well, even though it's not nimittas and the great piti sukhas and the four jhanas or anything like that, it's still pretty nice. And if you look upon that experience compared to everything else you do in life, you know, whether it's bathing or brushing your teeth or having to eat or going to the toilet or coming here and going there, compared to all that activity, your body and mind, the tranquility of the body and the mind is just so much nicer. It's because of the beauty, the happiness in these states, so that's the reason why it's a natural course. It has to happen that the mind inclines towards that, and inclines towards it and eventually reaches it. You don't have to really think about it, whether you can do it or you can't do it, how long it will take, or making resolutions, or thinking you're lazy. All those of you who made the tough resolutions and really going at Nibbana really hard, and all those ones who were lazy. Sometimes I give them a simile, it's like two people in an aircraft. One person is rushing up to the front, the other one is dozing in the back seat. They both get to the destination around the same time. It's not up to you. Now you're on this like aircraft, called the Eightfold Path. So whether you rush around or think you're driving or just think you're lazy, the path takes you. It's a fantastic thing, this path. The point is that you can't be lazy, you can't work too hard. It's not up to you. This is the nature of things. When you start to be calm and peaceful, the idea of effort, the idea of laziness, both of them just disappear. So much of effort is restlessness, udicca. So much of laziness is just tina mida, dullness. When those two hindrances are gone, you're beyond my effort, you're beyond dullness. Sort of it's the path you're on, and it's neither. And that path, just that tranquility of the body and mind, at least this is where the whole path starts to really get fun. This is when you get the sukha. This joy, this happiness, which is much more powerful than the piti, because you're going to tranquil mind states. Body disappears, that's what happens with kaya pasadi. When things calm down, they disappear. And they go, and they vanish, and so this whole business with the body is gone at last. Nothing to scratch anymore, nothing to irritate you anymore. Just emptiness, finished, disappeared, impermanent. And you've got this mind with all its thinking and doing. But that bit is gone. That's really what citta prasadi means. All the thinking, calm down. All the restlessness, calm down. And all the flitting from one sense to another sense, and hearing to feeling and all that sort of stuff, it's all calmed down. It's all disappeared. And that's why it's happy. This is lovely to have these states. And as it mind calms down more and more, and you get this beautiful happiness, it's a natural course. You don't have to think or make a resolution, oh, may I be happy now. You can do it if you want to, but it's not necessary. A lot of times you just let the natural process occur. That's why in Buddhism we keep on telling people, just to let go, get out of the way, don't interrupt or obstruct the process. This natural process, and I think it's in the Anguttara somewhere or other. And as we go deeper from sukha, this is actually this particular link in this process was, of course, my favorite one of all. It's just such a powerful link. From happiness you get samadhi. This is all just going deeper and deeper into bliss. And it's a natural course. And it's a wonderful process. You go into all this bliss of sukha. And sometimes you think, well, where's this going to lead? Am I going to get attached to this? Or is this dangerous? But it doesn't. It leads. Without even you wanting it to or not wanting it to. All the wanting and not wanting don't really count in this place. That's just all that stupid dhamma, wanting and not wanting. You've gone beyond this now. And just a part of the process. It's just what the mind does. From the happiness, it just builds up, snowballs, bliss upon bliss upon bliss upon bliss. And it just snowballs into samadhi, into bliss states. And you're just sitting here. The sooner you get out of the way and let the natural process happen, the better, the faster. So often that people want to try and control the process. And that sutta says, look, you don't need to. In fact, when you try and control the process, you just, you know, you mess it all up. You get in the way. And, you know, you're denying yourself these beautiful, blissful samadhi states. And it's a natural course, it just happens. It's like the inclination of the mind. You start in this direction, as long as you don't interfere with it, this is where it goes. And some of you experience these things all the time when you get in your deep meditations. What have you done to get the deep meditations? This is why I always try and sort of remind you that after a good meditation, even a medium meditation, whatever meditation state you think you're up to, even if it's just, you know, getting to present moment awareness, maybe just for 1 second the whole range retreat or whatever, it doesn't matter. Whatever you've got up to, just, you know, reflect on what that feels like after meditation. It's reflection on just what happiness truly is, what peace truly is, what tranquility truly is. And that reflection, and that's one of the great ways of conditioning the mind, so this process becomes even stronger and stronger and stronger. Because you're reminding the mind just about see where its happiness lies, and it will just incline to that, just as like a ball rolls downhill. You don't have to tell the ball where to roll, that's just where it rolls. It's the nature of balls going downhill. They roll down, they never go sideways or up. Same as the mind, it just goes into the bliss, if you just let it. And when you sort of go into the bliss of samadhi, you know, that's when you start to, you know, really get something out of this monastic life. I think it's a Sandika Sutta was saying that the holy life is just without consolation if you don't get first jhana or beyond. In other words, and this is the first big payoff of, you know, living the holy life. Okay, I mean, actually you get, you know, minor payoffs, first of all. It's you have a lot of tranquility and a lot of happiness living monastic life. You do nice things for nice people. It's a nice community over here. You know, we enjoy each other's company. You can't live with a better group of people than in a monastery like this. So virtuous, so compassionate, so good to each other. You know, how many arguments have you had with each other during the range retreat? Okay, those of you who had an argument, I don't think I've had an argument with people, with any person during the range retreat. If you had an argument with anybody during this range retreat, sort of, you know, that's tiny compared to, you know, the arguments you have even in one day out there in the big bad world. So when you put things in perspective, this is a very tranquil, harmonious, you know, kind place, you know, where kind people live together. And you can actually see that just the happiness, even that much, you know, it inclines the mind to seek that again and again and again. And in samadhi, when the mind just goes into these bliss states naturally without you forcing them, you're getting a sort of a very good picture of what the path to ending suffering is. And after the jhanas, what happens next? You know, this natural process, without even needing to do it or make any resolutions, it's nature that you'll see things as they truly are. Yatha Bhuta Jnana Dasanam. Yatha means as, Bhuta, they are, Jnana Dasanam, knowledge and vision. This is where you get the insights from. I'm not talking about the small insights, the big insights with a capital I. And these big insights, always based on samadhi, you know, based on the deep meditations. And they're based on those deep meditations for the two reasons. One, because the mind is empowered, strong and bright and brilliant, it can see deeply into things. And secondly, because you've got the data of the jhanas to work with. New information, new experiences, beautiful experiences, but also profound changes of consciousness, where you start to see things in a completely different light because of that data. You don't need to actually make that resolution, the Buddha said. It just happens naturally. Because sometimes people ask me, say, well, when you go into jhanas, if you do get into jhanas, just in case, you never know your luck, 5 days to go before the end of the range retreat, or 5 or 6 or something like that. If I get into jhanas the last few days, what do I do? And people keep asking that question because we're compulsive doers again. Now, you still think that you're doing this whole thing rather than just being a passenger on the journey. And you say, don't need to do anything. Some people say you have to do insight. And because I say you don't have to do insight, people think that Ajahn Bum doesn't teach insight. But insight happens naturally. You can't avoid it. It just happens. This is what that process says. From samadhi, you get yata bhuta yana dasana, seeing things as they truly are. Whether a person makes that resolution or not, whether they choose to do this, it's nature. They call it tamata. It's of the Dhamma. That when you get into deep meditations, you see things as they truly are. What do you see as they truly are? You see this life of the five sense world. It's just so unsatisfactory. It's actually suffering compared to the bliss of the jhanas. You see that. Because you've got the jhana data, what it's like in jhanas. You've got what it's like outside jhanas. Compared to those two, that's suffering. It's obvious. You can't miss it. You realize that the five senses are suffering. You get some real insight into the First Noble Truth. The First Noble Truth, they say, like the five khandhas are suffering. And some people continue to sort of say it's the attachment to the five khandhas is suffering. As though you don't attach them, the khandhas themselves, the body, feeling, perception, mental formations like thought and will and consciousness, they say that those by themselves aren't suffering, it's only when you attach to them it's suffering. But of course, those people don't have any experience, they're just misinterpreting teachings of the Buddha. If you actually have the experience, especially the experience of jhana, the real data to work with, you see very clearly that the khandhas by themselves are suffering. You know that because when the khandhas disappear, there's bliss. Or when most of the khandhas disappear, there's bliss. And when lots of khandhas are there, or they're there in a gross form, that's suffering. You compare the two. Absence of suffering is bliss. Absence of bliss is suffering. It's just the nature of like happiness and pain. Bliss and suffering. So you see this very clearly. And it gives you the great insights. These aren't small insights, these are great insights. About happiness. Start to look at food, sex, going here, watching movies, looking at flowers. Start to see all the beautiful flowers in a different way. They're not beautiful anymore. Because you know something much more, something much better. See all these sights, it's like an irritation. The Buddha gave a lovely simile of, I think it's Vedana, just like being this cow who's had been skinned alive. This poor cow. Just with all its outer skin, its hide, the tough part, just taken away, and just all these flies and mosquitoes, just irritating its sensitive skin. Just how much that would hurt and be irritating. That's a simile the Buddha used. And for all this Vedana, this sensory apparatus of ours. We're to see things, always having to see things, always having to hear these things. Always having to feel, the itches, the aches, the pains, or the pleasures of the body. It's just such an irritation. We take it to be normal if we don't know anything else. But, in this in jhanas, we see all these things disappear and go, finish with. Oh, what a relief. It's like having had a headache for years and you get the magic potion, it goes away. You've had this itch on your skin, and this skin disease, and it drives you mad sometimes, just scratching and scratching and scratching, just like hearing other people or seeing them misbehave in the kitchen or wherever else you are, it can drive you mad sometimes. It's just this itch, no matter how much you scratch and try and tell them what they should be doing, just the itch never goes away, until eventually just you let go. And you let go of those senses. The more you let go, the less it itches and less irritating it is. It's such a relief to get into a jhana, to let all these five senses and this body just disappear. Oh my goodness, this is wonderful. And these are the insights you get about the suffering of the of Karma Loka. You know, of the three worlds, the Tiloka, the Karma Loka, this is the sensory realm, right up to the, you know, the lower Brahma realms, well, not really the lower Brahma realms, but the Paranimitta Vasavati realm, the realm of Mara. Even that much, getting into jhanas, you're going beyond Mara, because Mara just lives in the five sense realms. You're going much higher than that. Beyond Mara. Mara can't reach you in those states. Doesn't know what you're doing in those states. Beyond Mara. And so when you get into those states and you enjoy that bliss, Yathabhuta Yanadasana comes. You see things as they truly are. You see beyond Mara, what Mara doesn't know. You know, Mara, the tempter, or whatever else, the evil one, delusion. You get beyond all that. Yathabhuta Yanadasana. Seeing things as they truly are. This is where you get all your insights and wisdoms. These are the powerful ones. The ones that send you into stream winning, once returning, non-returning, arahat. That's why that I'm going to put it in here just because I like this. And you've heard it all before. And everyone knows this. Pasadika Sutta. I'm just indulging right now because I love this quote. Anyone who indulges in the four jhanas can expect only one of four fruits, one of four benefits. Nothing other than those four, just one of them. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or arahat, the four stages of enlightenment. That's what happens if you indulge in the jhanas, indulge in letting go. And I call it indulge, it's really like devoted to. Anuyuta, that's the same word really. You do a lot of it, you really get into it. Yathabhuta Yanadasana has to happen whether you like it or not. Whether you want it or not, whether you try or not, insight comes to you, rather than you trying to go out to the insight. And then what happens after that? This is, again, another fascinating part. A lot of times people stop at insight and don't go further along the chain. What happens after insight? You get this amazing quality called Nibbida. We just chanted all that in the Anattalakkhana Sutta. You know, Rupe Supi Nibbindati, Vedanayapi Nibbindati. We get Nibbida to all these five khandhas. And what Nibbida means is like this revulsion, repulsion. It's not coming from aversion, because that's coming from a sense of self, of me. It's not I don't like these things, it's just natural. The mind turns away. The mind gets repelled. The whole sort of process of consciousness, you know, seeing that these things are not conducive to happiness at all, but actually conducive to suffering, just turns away from these things, you know, automatically, just like the hand pulls away from a fire. You know, it's not as if the hand has aversion for a fire. If you don't put your hand in a fire, you can't live in it. It means you've got ill will towards being burnt. That's stupid saying things like that. It's just natural. The aversion, or rather the repulsion, comes, and it's being repelled from the wheel of samsara. Pushes you off into cessation, into enlightenment. And this is Nibbida. It's beautiful. From Nibbida, you don't have to make a resolution where get viraga, the fading away of things. It's called it dispassion, the fading away of passion, but it's also many more things fading away. You start seeing just the whole universe just melting, evaporating, and going into nothing. You start to see your body just falling apart, dripping into nothingness. You start to see all of them, the five, six senses. It's all turning off, going, fading away. And then start to see the mind fading away. You have to fade away. That's a process of dissolution. Dissolution of an empty process. And then it gets cessation. The end of things. I think actually it's vimutti in that process, not cessation yet, just freedom, and vimutti jhana. Cessation comes afterwards, at the end of one's life, parinibbana. You see the whole process, and the point is that it's not a person who is driving that car, it's not a person walking that journey, it just happens all by itself. Marvellous actually to see that happening, and be an observer in this great journey, which happens whether you like it or not. So that's the sense of selflessness, that sense of non-doing, that sense of contentment, that sense of going through all these jhanas and all these bliss states and going through, you know, the nibbida and the viraga and the nirodhas, seeing everything end. You're just a passenger on this Eightfold Path, this old way which the Buddha found and which arahats of all genders have just practiced for 2500 years in this Buddha cycle. They're still practicing it, that path is still there, it's well trodden. And each one of you are on part of that path. It's only a matter of time. The seed has been planted. And I don't think that many of you can avoid it, you know, too long. Because there's something inside each one of us. Sometimes you wonder why it is that people come to a monastery like this, and why some people can't come to a monastery like this. And there must be some sort of karma there in the past. And there's some recognition, you know, deep in the mind. You've heard these teachings before, and I'm not talking about last week, I'm talking about long time ago. A long time ago. And there's something inside which resonates with these teachings. I'm only sort of reminding you of what you heard a long time ago. And these teachings, they resonate because you can see their direction. Just like the waters of the Ganges always slope towards the ocean. They don't go back up to the Himalayas. They slope downwards. So this path just slopes to Nibbana. And you actually see that happening, and you can recognize that happening. And you know you're sloping down there. You know that when you're sort of in that river, in that stream, you're going to get to the ocean sooner or later. Samsara's days are numbered. It's only a matter of time. So a lot of times that we get sort of worried about how well we've done or how well we haven't done. At the end of a retreat period, sometimes people start judging themselves and they're judging each other and they ask, how did you do and how did I do and all that sort of stuff. It doesn't really matter, it's a waste of time. Even ends of retreats and beginnings of retreats, the practice changes slightly, but the practice doesn't really stop at all. There's a whole momentum built up in the Rains Retreat. And that momentum is not the momentum of will. It's just the momentum of the process which leads to Nibbana, this empty process. It's hard sometimes to say who's a Sadanusari and who's a Dhammanusari. These are the two types of beings on the path to stream winning or stream entry. And I look at those factors in the suttas, and I look at just how that works in experience. And you see that after a while that people have got some idea inside of them about, you know, what this is all about. Or they've got some faith in that idea. There's something inside the mind which leaps to that and finds joy and delight in it. And that's one sort of meaning of faith. I think they have this word, sampasada. You have faith in things. It really means actually you have joy in it. The word faith and the word sort of joy, confidence, and sort of inspiration, what you have faith in, sometimes you get inspired in. What you get inspired with, you have faith in. And that inspiration always has this quality of joy, delight. And so you can actually see that sometimes when you have faith in these things, when you delight in those things, that by itself is just going to catch you and sort of get this whole process of your five khandhas on the path to enlightenment. Or if you sort of got some understanding of this Dharma, you can actually see it, not fully, not completely, but you've seen enough of it to know that this is on the way to Nibbana, and you can't resist it. You're on the path. So if you don't do it before you die, you will, when you die, become a stream winner. And just look at in the suttas, the sort of people who became stream winners. And there's some people who were far less advanced than each one of you, you know, who became, you know, listened to the Buddha and actually become a stream winner. Sometimes I think that it was almost impossible to believe that these guys become stream winners, but a lot of times I think it's because of the faith in the Buddha they became people on the path to stream entry, Sadanusaris. Some were very sharp and became Dhammanusaris. And these were ordinary people. I think there's something inside each one of us which recognizes this. The longer you go on that path, the more you recognize, the more it feels the way which you should be going in your life, that you feel the happiness, no matter how far you've reached or not reached, is something which can tell you this is the path, this is the way to full liberation from suffering. And, you know, it's irresistible. Because that's the nature of the path. That's what that sutta was saying. Whether you make a resolution or not, this happens. That's what it means, it's irresistible. It just happens. It's a path. Once you get on the start of it, you're locked in, as it were. And so that as we go on this path towards Nirvana, that, you know, we get these sometimes, and we don't get stream winning at the death, you get it beforehand. Sometimes you just see the Dhamma, you understand what the Buddha saw. You understand just all about what this, you know, the Buddha was talking about. The suttas become alive. And you start to see just amazing, beautiful things in these suttas. And the insight will come up that, you know, one is a stream winner. That's just what happens. And so if you do these things, that this is what you can expect. And of course it's quite inspiring to see what the Buddha says about, you know, what stream winning is like. You know, I was looking this reference up. I was actually looking up another reference, but, you know, it's similar enough that I got this reference as well, about having a tiny piece of soil on your finger, which is the more. The tiny piece of soil which is on my finger, or the amount of suffering which is left for the stream winner. So the real simile is, which is more, the tiny piece of soil on my finger or the great mountains in the Himalayas? So the tiny piece of dirt, soil on your finger is incomparable, it's so small, it's insignificant to the mass of the great Himalayas. And the Buddha said, in the same way, the amount of suffering left for a stream winner is small, tiny, in comparison to all the suffering which has gone before. Just like the small piece of dirt compared to the great range of the Himalaya mountains. So many of you are close to experiencing that already by getting to a monastery and by practicing in this way, listening to Dhamma. Already you're sort of, you haven't got much dirt left on your fingers. And so little by little you get closer and closer to seeing the Dhamma. And seeing just the emptiness of everything, seeing the five khandhas, there's nothing in there, just an empty process. Understanding the path to Nibbana has to be an empty process. Can't be any other way. Just to see it's all a way of letting go, of contentment. And the way we run the monastery, the way the Buddha laid down the Vinaya, you know, the whole teachings of the Dhamma, they can all see the thread which runs through everything. You know, the way of renunciation, of release, of letting go. You understand the Dhamma, you understand the Vinaya. Remember that advice to Upali and to Mahapajapati, the first bhikkhuni? You know, whatever leads, if I can remember it again, to Nibbida. This repulsion, Nibbida, Viraga, I think it's Nirodha. So this is the first three terms, I think there's seven in these terms, the first three terms of like repulsion, fading away, cessation, Upasama, Abhinya. Upasama, this is what peace means. This is like samatha, upasama, calming things down. Calm, peace, tranquility, just the silence of the body, the silence of the mind, when he gets really still, blissfully still into jhanas and beyond. This is upasama. And abhinya is like this deep knowing. Just like I have abhidharma, just the deep dharma, this is abhijnana. So it's like the deep understanding. This is real insight, powerful insight. Abhinya, is it Abhinyopasamaya, Abhinyaya, Nibbanaya. I missed out somewhere. Sambodaya. That's right, Sambodhi and Nibbana. Sambodhi is enlightenment. So from Abhinya, deep understanding, to sort of the Sambodhi. This is actually enlightenment. And then sort of Nibbana. The cessation, complete disappearing, gone out, finished. So whatever Dhamma and Vinaya leads to those seven things, said the Buddha, you can know for sure, absolutely, this is the Dhamma, this is the Vinaya of the Buddha. It's actually, this is the teaching of the Buddha, this is the Dhamma, this is the Vinaya, the three things. So what it's actually saying is the Dhamma is the Vinaya, is the teaching of the Buddha. All the same, because this thread goes through each one of those, the thread of repulsion from the world, from the five senses, from the sixth sense as well, and the khandhas and everything, the fading away of things, the cessation, the calm, the deep understanding, enlightenment understanding, and nibbana itself. So when it leads to those things, you say it's a Dhamma Vinaya and the teachings. So these are the Dhamma and the Vinaya. And this is the Vinaya lesson this evening. It's a Dhamma lesson, teaching the Buddha. It's leading to these wonderful things. One is going out. The suffering is fading away. Contentment is rising. It's a beautiful experience of the cessation of all these things. It's always hard to find similes from the natural world for these processes, but one of the similes which came into my mind years ago is like a meteor, like a shooting star at night. Because I know enough about science, about astrophysics. These are like solid lumps of ice mostly, a few other little particles in them, just whizzing around the solar system for thousands, millions of years. Probably thousands of millions of years, I think. Whizzing around, round and round and round and round and round and round and round, so many uncountable times, just like the amount of times you've been born and died in all the different realms. And after whizzing around, orbiting the solar system for such a long time, just one of them just happens, just by the law of averages, happens to come into the earth and meets the atmosphere of the earth. It just burns up and just disappears forever. And so then this simile, as it burns up, it always burns up in this beautiful light, this blaze of glory. And that's just like this other person, going around samsara, life after life after life, until it, by chance or by karma, just meets the teachings of the Buddha, like the lump of cosmic ice, just meeting the atmosphere of a planet, planet Earth here. And coming into contact, and just because it meets the Dhamma, it just burns up all the defilements, all the cravings, all the clingings. That's what the Dhamma does, it burns it up. As it burns it up, so if you go out in this blaze of bliss, this beautiful light of the Arahat, and then this beautiful last few seconds. Just like the life of an Arahat, just a few seconds in the cosmic time scale, the meteor in the human light scale, human life scale, only lasts a few seconds, brilliant light and then gone forever. I like that simile of the meteor going out in the blaze of glory. That's what the Arahat does, and so that's your destiny. And as you go out, you encourage other people to go out as well. That's a wonderful thing about the fact of our interactions between each other, as one goes, it brings a lot of other people with them. And this is, we don't need to make those resolutions. This is your, what's going to happen to you. So you haven't really got much choice in the matter. And you will put forth effort because of conditioning. You won't be able to be too lazy for too long because you can't resist it. The path. And the force of that path, which creates your effort and wearier and everything else of the path. And you've been doing this for 3 months. Some of you've been doing it for longer. Some you've been doing it for a long time. And it's just a matter of just keeping on going. I don't know if I say you should keep on going because you've got no choice anyway. Some of you will leave, but you won't be able to stop. You know that. Little by little, you get closer and closer. But one thing you can promise you. It gets happier and happier and happier, more and more fun, more and more fun, more and more peaceful, more and more enjoyable. So that's one of the inspiring things about monastic life. Generally speaking, as you look up the line of monks, you see them happier and happier the longer they stay, the deeper they practice. And that gives one encouragement. But this is not just like empty words, it's not just someone teaching from the suttas, not really understanding them, but just repeating what the Pali says. This is just what happens in the path of Nibbana. It's a beautiful path, it's an inspiring path. and each one of you have done extremely well during the last rains retreat. You've done extremely badly as well. It's no really good or bad, is it? It's just, you know, the way things turn out, the way they roll, whether you want to or you don't want to. It just happens. So I wish you all happiness after the retreat. I'll just say after the retreat, it just goes on. It's not real any difference. We'll be doing more good karma for the monastery, doing a lot of meditation. And you won't be able to resist the process. The process has started. And so it's only a matter of time. You know, when one reaches the far shore and knows that, you know, the whole problem is gone. The problem is that just we've got seeds which give rise to rebirth. You know the cause of rebirth. When that cause is eliminated, you know, the cause is eliminated to rebirth, then knowledge comes as no rebirth. That's how one knows one is enlightened or not, just to see whether there's any seeds are left there. So it's a path which happens. And so we wish everyone to enjoy that path. And as you enjoy that path, please bring along as many people with you as you can. So that's the talk this evening, Sadhu.
Bhagavato Sthavaka Sangho Sangham.